Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2011. English for Speakers of Other Languages, Higher. Section A, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the following lecture and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 1, before you start.
Good morning. I'm Dr. McKinnon from the Department of Human Genetics. I've been asked to give this interdisciplinary lecture because recent developments in genetics seem to raise issues, sometimes provide answers, and certainly can help to support lines of thought in other subject areas. That's why the arts faculty asked me to come and talk to you, and I'm assuming, since this is an open lecture, that you're here because you're interested. Now, I'd expect to find some historians here, yes? Any sociologists? Right. Well, I'm not going down the list, but other disciplines that tend to be interested might include political science, psychology, and so on. Let me start with an example you may be familiar with. In 1947, a Norwegian anthropologist, Thor Heyerdahl, sailed from the west coast of South America over 4,000 miles across the Pacific to the Tuamotu Islands in a replica wooden raft. The story's well known. His book was translated into many languages and there was a documentary film of the expedition. So, what was Heyerdahl trying to prove? Simply that the Pacific Islands could have been settled from South America? That the Polynesian people had come from there? Well, he certainly proved that it was possible for them to cross the ocean in the sort of boats they had, but anthropologists in general continued to believe, based on linguistic and cultural evidence, that settlement was from west to east, originating in the Asian mainland. Today, as the result of work done by Professor Brian Sykes in Oxford in 1992, we can say that the DNA supports the accepted theory. Sykes found genetic matches right back through the Pacific Islands to New Guinea and Borneo, even as far as Taiwan. Now, this didn't really affect academic thinking in any significant way, because most anthropologists were fairly sure of their existing conclusions, but it does stand as an example of how genetics can support thinking in other disciplines. Now, I think it's fair to say that there is a history of suspicion against genetics, particularly from those on the political left. This seems to relate to the idea that genetics supports the concept of racial differences. But I'd put it to you that modern developments have turned this upside down. The fact is that you get your DNA from your parents, and they get it from their parents. So you might find that the closest match to your DNA, apart from your immediate family, is someone living on the other side of the world with whom you share a common ancestor, maybe 50,000 years ago. We're in the early stages now, but we're beginning to build up a picture of movement and interaction among human beings over the centuries that we simply couldn't get from historical sources. To use myself as an example, one of my own DNA sequences is almost unknown in the West Highlands, which is where my immediate family come from. Good morning. I'm Dr. McKinnon from the Department of Human Genetics. I've been asked to give this interdisciplinary lecture because recent developments in genetics seem to raise issues, sometimes provide answers, and certainly can help to support lines of thought in other subject areas. That's why the arts faculty asked me to come and talk to you, and I'm assuming, since this is an open lecture, that you're here because you're interested. Now, I'd expect to find some historians here, yes? Any sociologists? Right. Well, I'm not going down the list, but other disciplines that tend to be interested might include political science, psychology, and so on. Let me start with an example you may be familiar with. In 1947, a Norwegian anthropologist, Thor Heyerdahl, sailed from the west coast of South America over 4,000 miles across the Pacific to the Tuamotu Islands in a replica wooden raft. The story's well known. His book was translated into many languages, and there was a documentary film of the expedition. So, what was Heyerdahl trying to prove? Simply that the Pacific Islands could have been settled from South America? That the Polynesian people had come from there? Well, he certainly proved that it was possible for them to cross the ocean in the sort of boats they had, but anthropologists in general continued to believe, based on linguistic and cultural evidence, that settlement was from west to east, originating in the Asian mainland. Today, as the result of work done by Professor Brian Sykes in Oxford in 1992, we can say that the DNA supports the accepted theory. Sykes found genetic matches right back through the Pacific Islands to New Guinea and Borneo, even as far as Taiwan. Now, this didn't really affect academic thinking in any significant way, because most anthropologists were fairly sure of their existing conclusions, but it does stand as an example of how genetics can support thinking in other disciplines. Now, I think it's fair to say that there is a history of suspicion against genetics, particularly from those on the political left. This seems to relate to the idea that genetics supports the concept of racial differences. But I'd put it to you that modern developments have turned this upside down. The fact is that you get your DNA from your parents, and they get it from their parents. So you might find that the closest match to your DNA, apart from your immediate family, is someone living on the other side of the world with whom you share a common ancestor maybe 50,000 years ago. We're in the early stages now, but we're beginning to build up a picture of movement and interaction among human beings over the centuries that we simply couldn't get from historical sources. To use myself as an example, one of my own DNA sequences is almost unknown in the West Highlands, which is where my immediate family come from.
Recording 2. Listen to the conversation between two people and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 2, before you start.
Do you want the last biscuit?
No, help yourself. Anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, I got tired of working for my dad and started looking for something else.
Weren't you getting on with him?
Actually, we've always got on fine. I didn't go through all the usual Asian teenage girl stuff. Wanting to go to clubs and stay out late, and Dad trying to...
It's not just Asian teenage girls that go through that. It's all teenage girls, teenage boys too.
Yes, but it's worse for Asians, especially if the parents didn't grow up here. There's just too much difference between the two cultures. Anyway, what I'm trying to get across is that wasn't a problem. I didn't want to do all that clubbing stuff.
So what was the problem?
Well, like I said, partly it was working in Dad's shop. I got bored. But it was also the type of shop.
It's that biggish one on the corner of Bridge Street, isn't it?
Yes. Scottish flags, polyester kilts for 30 quid, big reproduction swords, a load of tat mainly.
Oh, come on, don't be such a snob. It's catering for a market.
Yeah, the rubbish market. The thing is, well, I was born here, grew up here. I think of myself as Scottish. Okay, Asian background, but I've never even been to Pakistan. And I'd like to do something in tourism, as a career, like. I've got quite interested in the whole tartan, Scottish culture thing.
But that's just stuff we sell to the tourists. If anything, it's Highland culture, and it's not particularly genuine at that.
Yes, I know all that. Still, you got married last year, didn't you?
You know I did. You were at the wedding.
And what did you wear?
A kilt. Guilty as charged.
As did your brother and a good number of the male guests. Mike Trotter. Good old Highland name, Trotter, not?
Yeah, I know. It's got nothing to do with the Highlands. But it's still a fact that most tartans date from the 19th century or later, when all this Highland stuff become fashionable.
And your point is, it's still history. The King, George IV, visited Edinburgh in 1822 and wore a kilt, and everybody got dressed up in kilts for the occasion, and that's what kicked off the tartan and tourist industry. So what? A later King George, George V, visited India in 1911 and everybody got dressed up in traditional costume. Most of them probably wore Western suits the rest of the time. It's nothing new.
Okay. So where's your new job?
It's in Sanderson's. They've got a branch in the old town.
Yes, I know it. And let me see, they sell designer jumpers, kilts that cost about 300 quid, tartan stuff for people with money.
Yep, it costs more. That's more or less it.
And I suppose you get Americans called Schwarzenegger coming in to find their authentic clan tartan.
A bit like that sometimes. Yes, some of the time. And I do my best for them. Tell me, Mike, did any of your family ever marry someone from overseas?
Yes, me.
Yes, I know that Claudia's Italian. I meant further up the family tree.
Nope, you've got me there. Generations of Lowland Scots.
So you've got no idea of this need to belong to something, to somewhere? Well, maybe your kids will, if you ever get round to having any.
Maybe, yes, I suppose so.
Look, at home I sometimes wear traditional Pakistani clothes. And what does that add up to? The dress of a country I've never been to and might never go to? But that culture's still a part of me, and I can't just ignore it. I was talking about this need to belong, with an Australian couple last week. It was their first visit to Scotland. Both of them had Scottish ancestors. They felt the same way as I did.
So you sold him a kilt and her a tartan skirt?
Of course. We're a commercial business, not a personal counselling service. Now I'm going to have to go. I start work again in 10 minutes.
Do you want the last biscuit?
No, help yourself. Anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, I got tired of working for my dad and started looking for something else.
Weren't you getting on with him?
Actually, we've always got on fine. I didn't go through all the usual Asian teenage girl stuff. Wanting to go to clubs and stay out late, and Dad trying to...
It's not just Asian teenage girls that go through that. It's all teenage girls, teenage boys too.
Yes, but it's worse for Asians, especially if the parents didn't grow up here. There's just too much difference between the two cultures. Anyway, what I'm trying to get across is that wasn't a problem. I didn't want to do all that clubbing stuff.
So what was the problem?
Well, like I said, partly it was working in Dad's shop. I got bored. But it was also the type of shop.
It's that biggish one on the corner of Bridge Street, isn't it?
Yes. Scottish flags, polyester kilts for 30 quid, big reproduction swords, a load of tat mainly.
Oh, come on, don't be such a snob. It's catering for a market.
Yeah, the rubbish market. The thing is, well, I was born here, grew up here. I think of myself as Scottish. Okay, Asian background, but I've never even been to Pakistan. And I'd like to do something in tourism, as a career-like. I've got quite interested in the whole tartan, Scottish culture thing.
But that's just stuff we sell to the tourists. If anything, it's Highland culture, and it's not particularly genuine at that.
Yes, I know all that. Still, you got married last year, didn't you?
You know I did. You were at the wedding.
And what did you wear?
A kilt. Guilty as charged.
As did your brother and a good number of the male guests. Mike Trotter. Good old Highland name, Trotter, not?
Yeah, I know. It's got nothing to do with the Highlands. But it's still a fact that most tartans date from the 19th century or later, when all this Highland stuff become fashionable.
And your point is, it's still history. The King, George IV, visited Edinburgh in 1822 and wore a kilt, and everybody got dressed up in kilts for the occasion, and that's what kicked off the tartan and tourist industry. So what? A later King George, George V, visited India in 1911 and everybody got dressed up in traditional costume. Most of them probably wore Western suits the rest of the time. It's nothing new.
Okay. So where's your new job?
It's in Sanderson's. They've got a branch in the old town.
Yes, I know it. And let me see, they sell designer jumpers, kilts that cost about 300 quid, tartan stuff for people with money.
Yep, it costs more. That's more or less it.
And I suppose you get Americans called Schwarzenegger coming in to find their authentic clan tartan.
A bit like that sometimes. Yes, some of the time. And I do my best for them. Tell me, Mike, did any of your family ever marry someone from overseas?
Yes, me.
Yes, I know that Claudia's Italian. I meant further up the family tree.
Nope, you've got me there. Generations of Lowland Scots.
So you've got no idea of this need to belong to something, to somewhere? Well, maybe your kids will, if you ever get round to having any.
Maybe, yes, I suppose so.
Look, at home I sometimes wear traditional Pakistani clothes. And what does that add up to? The dress of a country I've never been to and might never go to? But that culture's still a part of me, and I can't just ignore it. I was talking about this need to belong, with an Australian couple last week. It was their first visit to Scotland. Both of them had Scottish ancestors. They felt the same way as I did.
So you sold him a kilt and her a tartan skirt?
Of course. We're a commercial business, not a personal counselling service. Now I'm going to have to go. I start work again in 10 minutes.
Recording 3. Listen to the conversation between three people and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 3, before you start. According to a Maori poll, 40% of us believe in ghosts and 37% have even seen, heard or felt one. But two psychologists think there might be a less spooky explanation for these experiences. One theory is that people might get strange feelings because in fact they are detecting naturally occurring patterns of electromagnetic fields. Then looking around for an explanation for the spooky sensation, people often decide it must have been a ghost. Professor Chris French of the University of London has tested this theory by building a so-called haunted room.
It was basically a completely featureless white chamber. We thought a real room might cause possible context effects. People might associate a wardrobe with something spooky. Before they went in, we told people, you'll spend 50 minutes in the space. You may be exposed to electromagnetic fields. Or not. They were told to record any unusual sensations and to make a note of the time they occurred.
And what did people say they felt?
A high proportion did report unusual sensations. Dizziness, for example, and so to that extent, we could claim some success in creating an artificial haunted room. It was a little disappointing that, although a lot of people reported unusual sensations, it didn't seem to matter what condition they were in. It would have been much more interesting if we had found we had actually induced these unusual sensations.
So sometimes there was no electromagnetic field, but they still thought that something spooky was going on.
Exactly.
Well, someone who's done research in a real place with a reputation for haunting is Dr. Jason Braithwaite. For 19 years, you've been studying at one of the UK's reportedly most haunted castles, Muncaster in Cumbria. What is it that's so unusual about Muncaster?
Well, over the period, we've started to map out something that we can only refer to as an electromagnetic anomaly. In the so-called haunted room, there's a very old bed with an iron mesh support in it, and it appears to be magnetised. Many people have reported strange experiences when lying there, and it's possible that there's a connection between this and the electromagneticism.
So what do you think's happening when people say they've seen or heard something?
Well, we didn't entirely expect to find this magnetic field. The question is that a coincidence? Chris has already touched upon a number of psychological explanations. There's the role of suggestibility. There's the role of context. Let's not forget we're in a medieval castle. There's also the role of the immediate experiential context, that you're surrounded by old furniture and portraits looking at you. All these things come into play.
Chris, what would be your explanation for what's happening?
I think the idea that electromagnetic fields might have an effect is an intriguing one, and one that does merit further research. I'm not 100% convinced at this stage, though, that this is the most plausible explanation. There are lots of other factors involved, as Jason outlined, and of course there are other cases where people think they may have a ghost in the attic, when in fact they've got rats, which my wife would find far more frightening. I'm not suggesting this of Muncaster, but some other famous hauntings have been deliberate hoaxes from start to finish. So, lots of explanations, but the evidence is suggestive enough that there just might be something in this idea.
According to a Maori poll, 40% of us believe in ghosts and 37% have even seen, heard or felt one. But two psychologists think there might be a less spooky explanation for these experiences. One theory is that people might get strange feelings because in fact they are detecting naturally occurring patterns of electromagnetic fields. Then looking around for an explanation for the spooky sensation, people often decide it must have been a ghost. Professor Chris French of the University of London has tested this theory by building a so-called haunted room.
It was basically a completely featureless white chamber. We thought a real room might cause possible context effects. People might associate a wardrobe with something spooky. Before they went in, we told people, you'll spend 50 minutes in the space. You may be exposed to electromagnetic fields, or not. They were told to record any unusual sensations and to make a note of the time they occurred.
And what did people say they felt?
A high proportion did report unusual sensations. Dizziness, for example, and so to that extent, we could claim some success in creating an artificial haunted room. It was a little disappointing that, although a lot of people reported unusual sensations, it didn't seem to matter what condition they were in. It would have been much more interesting if we had found we had actually induced these unusual sensations.
So sometimes there was no electromagnetic field, but they still thought that something spooky was going on.
Exactly.
Well, someone who's done research in a real place with a reputation for haunting is Dr. Jason Braithwaite. For 19 years, you've been studying at one of the UK's reportedly most haunted castles, Muncaster in Cumbria. What is it that's so unusual about Muncaster?
Well, over the period, we've started to map out something that we can only refer to as an electromagnetic anomaly. In the so-called haunted room, there's a very old bed with an iron mesh support in it, and it appears to be magnetised. Many people have reported strange experiences when lying there, and it's possible that there's a connection between this and the electromagneticism.
So what do you think's happening when people say they've seen or heard something?
Well, we didn't entirely expect to find this magnetic field. The question is that a coincidence? Chris has already touched upon a number of psychological explanations. There's the role of suggestibility. There's the role of context. Let's not forget we're in a medieval castle. There's also the role of the immediate experiential context, that you're surrounded by old furniture and portraits looking at you. All these things come into play.
Chris, what would be your explanation for what's happening?
I think the idea that electromagnetic fields might have an effect is an intriguing one, and one that does merit further research. I'm not 100% convinced at this stage, though, that this is the most plausible explanation. There are lots of other factors involved, as Jason outlined, and of course there are other cases where people think they may have a ghost in the attic, when in fact they've got rats, which my wife would find far more frightening. I'm not suggesting this of Muncaster, but some other famous hauntings have been deliberate hoaxes from start to finish. So, lots of explanations, but the evidence is suggestive enough that there just might be something in this idea.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.